So our last speaker is Mark Lee. Mark is the senior economist with the BC office of the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives. And Mark has written very widely on budgets, on the state of the economy, as well as on economic issues as they relate to health, education, and social policy. He's going to address the notion that's being widely promoted, especially by our provincial government in their so-called conversations about Medicare, that our current healthcare system is unsustainable, and not only is there no capacity for expansion, we're soon going to be spending so much on healthcare we won't be able to afford all the other social programs that we need. I think Mark's going to set us straight on that.
Okay, thank you very much. It's an honor to be on this distinguished panel with people like Murray Dobbin and Colleen Fuller, who have done so much over the years working on social justice issues. And I'd like to thank the Council of Canadians for having me here today. I'm not an expert on healthcare. I want to just be frank about that up front. The more I've read a lot about healthcare, I've been poking around, and I've, you know, I stacks of documents and research reports, and you know, the more I read, the more humbled I get about how expansive this issue is, and how complex some of the challenges we have are. So I'm an economist. I like numbers, and as part of the CCPA's work in looking at provincial finances, we've been looking at the financing of different aspects of our public services, and it started with a look at the financing of the K-12 education system, and then we looked at the financing of the post-secondary education system. And so for about a year and a half, I've been delving into literature and numbers and all kinds of stuff. You know, sometimes it's on the front burner, sometimes it's on the back burner, in the area of healthcare. And I've read a lot. I've tried to distill all of that into a research paper that will be released next month. And I think there's some pretty interesting findings, and I think they speak a lot to where we're going and what some of the challenges are and what some of the bogeymen are, the false idols that are sort of brought out. Bob Evans, who's an economist, a health economist at UBC, calls these the zombies. You know, these are ideas that have been killed, at least in the academic debate, for years, and yet they're continually resurrected and parade around the pages of our newspapers and our TV screens. So, in a nutshell, what I'm looking at is first of all this issue around population aging, the notion that we're sitting on this demographic time bomb, that you know healthcare expenditures are already you know out of control and they're commanding an ever greater share of our budget, and as soon as the baby boom generation retires en masse, then you know game over, folks. That's it. And I have to say that you know several years ago I you know found that argument somewhat compelling. And it wasn't really till I started diving into the numbers myself that I've become convinced that population aging is actually not a huge bogeyman in terms of the future of healthcare. But along the way, I've discovered that we do have a really big challenge, and the challenge isn't so much the you know the fact that our population is getting older. It's the fact that we have more and more technological possibilities at our disposal, and I mean that in the broadest sense of the term. You know, pharmaceutical drugs, new types of surgical techniques, new diagnostics, implants, transplants. You know, genetic screening and testing and biotechnology, and you can probably dream up a whole bunch of other stuff, you know, the limit of which is defined only by the imagination of people. So the issue of technology and how we manage it, and how we manage it within the context of a public system, I think is a really important question when for any particular ailment, you know, the sky is the limit if there is unlimited resources. And so the good news is that we're not facing this demographic time bomb that we have no control over. It is instead an issue around technology that, in at least if we keep it in the context of a public system, we do have a lot of control over. Now that raises a huge ethical issues, and it means we have to make choices, and it means we have to study about what works and what doesn't work, as opposed to what's constantly being pushed forward as the latest thing. But I think it's, to me, it's hopeful in the sense that I think we can find ways of managing it. And the experience of healthcare is that in the areas that are covered by public health insurance, you know, hospitals and doctors, that's where we see costs contained. It's in all of the areas that aren't covered by a public system where you've seen the massive escalation, and Colleen talked about that in the context of private insurance. So part and parcel of this is how do we expand the notion of public insurance to cover more and more aspects of the healthcare system relative to the very narrow doctors and hospital stuff that we think about that's covered by the Canada Health Act. Okay, that's the synopsis. The idea is to give you a sense of the relative proportions. So we all know this is true. The proportion of seniors relative to the overall population is rising over time. But what you often don't hear is that the share of children in the population is declining. So there may be upward pressure to some extent in terms of healthcare costs, because those are, you know, predominantly incurred by seniors, but that'll be offset by a reduction in the amount that we need to spend educating and caring for children. So what we need to look at is the sum of those two elements together. And it's true that these are expected to rise up by 2031. And 2031 is basically what the demographers estimate to be the peak in Canada. That's when the share of seniors relative to the population will be at its maximum. After 2031, it starts to decline a little bit. So to the extent that there is a demographic problem or challenge, we build up to a peak, and then it starts to dissipate. So, you know, the notion that it's not manageable, I don't think is really on. And furthermore, if you look at the sum of children and seniors together, you find that even though it's, you know, rising, you know, after 2010 or so, even at the peak in 2031, it's still lower than it was in the early 1970s. So it's not like we haven't been there before in terms of, you know, the population that needs to be serviced through the taxes largely paid by the working age population. This is something that I think forms the basis of a lot of the fears around an aging population. And this is sort of expenditures per capita or per person when you look at it by different age groups. Under age one, you know, tends to be a lot because, you know, being born is kind of expensive. Thereafter, it drops, and it's pretty low for most of the range. And then it starts to scale up all the way to, over $20,000 per person over 90. So if you take that graph and you say, well, you know, the population is aging, you know, surely this means that we're going to get pushed over a cliff. And the catch to this is that these are looking at averages for whole age groups. And what people have, there's been some really interesting research that's been done that finds that it's not that 90-year-olds cost so much more relative to the average. What costs a lot is dying. You will spend, on average, about a third of your total healthcare dollars in the public system in your final year of life, and about half of your total healthcare dollars in your final 2 years of life. So the general pattern in reality is that, you know, the levels are pretty low, even for the over 65 demographic who are not in their final year of life. It does go up a little bit, but not by a huge amount. But it's that last year of life, that's where we're spending a lot of money. So for on a per person basis, you know, on average for people under 65, $362 per year for a man, $429 per year for a woman. If you're over 65, it goes up $666 for men, $545 for women. So, you know, it does go up. There is an element of this that, you know, that the older you get, the more prone you are to illness and various things, and that's going to cost more. But for all ages, in your last year of life, for men, $29,000, okay, compared to $666. For women, $51,000. So this is the little bit of a hint that you're getting around this stuff to do with technology. And the researchers have called this, so it's not so much the cost of living, that the older you get, the more costly it is in terms of your healthcare expenditures. It's the cost of dying. And there's a lot of evidence that you know, we can spend a lot of money in those final years of life. And it's not that we necessarily should or should not do. I'm not trying to make a value judgment about that. But it comes down a lot to issues of quality of life and what people actually want. I break these out into four different areas. So, you know, we live in a world of growth. The economy is growing, prices are going up. All of that kind of stuff. And you can basically break healthcare costs down into four main things. One is inflation. This is just the price of purchasing healthcare services, the annual increase it costs to have doctors and nurses on staff, the cost of buying your supplies, and all that type of stuff. Inflation in terms of the cost of providing the same amount of healthcare services. Second thing is population growth. The amount by which the population grows over time. If you double the population, you're going to double your total amount of healthcare expenditures. Pretty straightforward. The third is population aging, this thing I mentioned before. And the fourth one is it's a bit of an awkward term, but they call it enrichment. That is the notion of the expansion of healthcare services. So part of the reason why healthcare costs have increased over 30 years is that we actually provide a lot more healthcare services than we did in 1975. Now, you know, they're in terms of the, you know, criticisms of healthcare, you know, obviously we could do more, we could do better, but the notion that, you know, we have more home care, we have more long-term care facilities than we did in 1975. Now, those have been declining under the current government, but I'm talking about the big sweep of history in terms of the package of healthcare services that everyone gets as part of the public system. So I've just plotted the first three, population growth, inflation, and population aging on this. I put them as an index, so it's basically trying to show the broad percentage change over time. So the least biggest single cost driver in the healthcare system is just in inflation, the notion that, you know, we have to pay more for doctors' salaries and nurses and that type of stuff. Population growth is a bigger factor, and population aging, you know, is a cost driver, but it's a relatively small one. In fact, it's of the four I mentioned, it is the single smallest one, the one that you have to actually worry the least about. Now, if you take the sort of total amount of dollars in healthcare over, you know, the 30-year period, and then you strip away population growth, and you strip away inflation, you strip away the impact that population aging has, you get this
sort of residual measure of enrichment. It's not perfect, but essentially this, I'm trying to illustrate the point that we have actually seen an expansion of healthcare services over time, and the large part of it, this whole swoop of the graph, is, you know, I think more truly what we would think of in terms of expanding the amount of healthcare services available to people in terms of things like long-term care facilities. You can see the dip there that happened in the 90s with the restraint, and then it shoots up again here. But this last little part is tricky because it certainly doesn't feel like we've received this much more in terms of healthcare services. And I think this is again pointing to this issue of technology, that we are spending a lot more in terms of the technology, and that's actually crowding out other things in the healthcare system. So let me delve into that a little bit more. I took a few different scenarios. I looked at the demographic projections that that BC Stats does in terms of what we expect for population growth, what we expect for population aging. You know, I took a sort of 10-year estimate of what inflation in the healthcare system has been, and I projected that forward to 2031. So what happens when you do that is that the total amount of healthcare dollars by 2031 will be about triple what it is today. Now, if I wanted to paint a really scary picture, I would just leave it at that. You know, oh my God, healthcare is going to triple, run for the hills. It would be the Carol Taylor trick. But the fact of the matter is that the economy is going to grow over this time as well. And so what I did was I took three different scenarios of what that would mean in terms of economic growth. And ultimately what we should be concerned about is not how much our healthcare expenditures are as a percentage of our total budget. This is the Carol Taylor thing, that, you know, by 20 or 17 or something like that, that healthcare is going to consume, you know, 70% of our budget. And that's, I have an antidote to that, and that's actually, we need to actually spend more money on the other stuff. We need to, you know, fight poverty, and we need to put money into the education system, and that will reverse that. But the proper benchmark in terms of future healthcare affordability is what share of our total income are we spending on healthcare? And that total income share, you know, and I would add the caveat that, you know, this is a measure that has its problems. But the general one we use is GDP. So if you look at a medium growth scenario, which is the black in the middle, which is a, you know, a 5% growth per year, which is, you know, about in line with the rates of economic growth we've seen going back to 1991. So remember the horrible economy and the terrible NDP years and all of that. Average rate of economic growth in those years, and this is in nominal terms, is about 5% per year. Well, if we have that, then the share of healthcare expenditures relative to GDP actually will fall from its current level of 7% to just over 6%. If the economy actually exceeds that and is close to what the historical average is going back to 1980, then the share of healthcare expenditures relative to the economy falls even further. Only in the low growth scenario, which again is not, there's no historical precedent for such weak levels of economic growth over a long sweep of time, does healthcare expenditures relative to GDP actually increase. And even then, it only increases by 1 percentage point of GDP, so 1 cent out of every new dollar of income. It's not a huge amount of money to absorb. So basically, under the implication you can take from this, under the medium or the high growth scenario, is that we actually have room to expand the suite of healthcare services that we're providing. We could expand the amount of pharmaceutical coverage. We could bring in dental coverage into the public healthcare system. We can contemplate actually expanding that. And so in the second set of scenarios, what I did was I just plotted that out. I took all of the same cost drivers, and then I added on a few different scenarios of this sort of troublesome enrichment concept. Now, I did a scenario where there's 1% per year, and I did a scenario where there's 2% a year. The historical average going back to 1975 is halfway in that. It's 1.6% per year, which doesn't sound like a whole lot, but you got to imagine this over the span of decades, that a little bit goes a long way when it's cumulative in that sense. So even under the 1% enrichment rate, you know, it does creep up to just over 8%. So, 8 cents out of every dollar that we're making covers not only an aging population, but an expansion of healthcare services. I think that's actually a pretty good deal.
So let me just take my last few moments to talk a bit more about this issue around technology. Because, I mean, healthcare, you know, at its core, is intertwined with the idea of technology, of new possibilities, of finding techniques to make people who are sick in some way better. Ultimately, you know, it's difficult to get a handle on how much technology is costing us in the healthcare system. That's why a lot of what I've shown you is kind of poking at it from different directions, but it's really hard to get a handle of. The only area where we have some good numbers on is the area of pharmaceutical drugs. So the challenge with new technologies is that, you know, it increases the realm of what's possible, and that means that it's going to cost more money over time. And there's some really interesting examples that I came across in terms of what this means for the future. The first one is surgical techniques, new types of surgical techniques that are non-invasive, what they're often called day surgeries. We see this a lot in areas like hip replacements, knee replacements, cataracts. These are the areas that 20 years ago, if you had this type of operation, you'd be laid up in a hospital for a week or more. And now, I mean, you can basically go in, throw you in a cab. Maybe they kind of push you out the door a little too quickly. But the recovery times are dramatically less. So what's that done? It's expanded the availability of knee and hip replacements well beyond the amount that could have been provided 20 years ago. So the cost per knee transplant or knee replacement is a lot less, but way more people are able to get access to it. So, to the credit of the BC government, we've seen a very large increase in knee and hip transplants, like far beyond the amount that would be required relative to population growth or even population aging. But, you know, my conclusion of this is that, you know, the size of the potential pool of people who are able to avail themselves of this of these new surgical techniques has meant that that's why we still have the waiting lists that we do. So, and you know, I think this is something that is being addressed over time. But I mean, this is the fundamental thing that's going on. It's not so much cuts in this area; it's technology. Diagnostics is another area where new technology drives demand for the very technology that's being created. And again, I don't want to put value judgments on whether that's good or bad, but the availability of CAT scans, MRIs, PET scans are kind of the latest thing, mean that, you know, more people can avail themselves that, and that becomes a cost driver in the system. Pharmaceutical drugs. We know that when we break up the major categories of drug expenditures, the single fastest growing category is drugs. And, you know, pharmaceuticals are not under the Canada Health Act. They are covered inconsistently across the country as a result. And that's, I think, the impetus for having a national pharmaceutical plan, that we can put in place measures that control those costs if we are able to take advantage of a national market. We can reform our patent laws so that the new drugs coming on don't receive the monopoly profits that they do. We can add things like compulsory licensing, which allow generic manufacturers to produce drugs for the market. We can engage in bulk purchasing, which will reduce costs. We can create a national formulary of the kind of core essential drugs that'll be covered from coast to coast. We can tackle things like overprescription of drugs. So, you know, I think that the example of drugs shows us, oh, one more thing I forgot, which is a BC innovation that came out under the NDP, which is reference-based pricing, which means that the government will only pay for the lowest cost drug with similar therapeutic effect. This program is so successful that even when the Liberals came in intending to kill it, they realized that they couldn't because it would cost them a whole lot more money. So the example of drugs shows us that there are lots of ways that we can control these costs and manage them in the context of a public system, but we need to more fully bring that within a public system. Final challenge in terms of technology is end-of-life care. Coming back to this issue of the final years of life, we really need to think carefully about the use of very expensive technological interventions at the end of life. And it seems to me that most seniors out there don't necessarily want to be hooked up in a hospital to all of this sophisticated equipment unless it improves their quality of life. And that's the real key question here. But the notion of accepting death and dying with dignity, I think, is gaining more currency in how people think about this stuff. What we see in terms of hospitals, for example, is that all this new technology, which has largely been accommodated within the system, higher proportion of budgets being spent on drugs, higher proportion spent on technology, I think is actually causing some of the crisis that we're seeing in hospitals, because it's crowding out other stuff that we can do. The evidence is not huge on this, but there's some very respectable people who've been talking about it, and I think it's an interesting area that again shines a light on the technology thing. Like I said, all of this dealing with this issue of technology poses ethical challenges to us. A lot of things in terms of technology demand a more thorough assessment. That even in a lot of interventions that we sort of think of as commonplace, heart surgery or back surgery, the evidence of whether these things actually work, that actually improve your likelihood of dying or surviving, your quality of life, 5 years after the intervention, isn't necessarily a lock. So when it comes down to how we deal with technology, the Romano Commission spoke about what are called health technology assessments, meaning that we need to sort of thoroughly test new technologies and see what the costs are and see what the benefits are and see what actually works. And to conclude, I would add a final ingredient in all of this, that ultimately these come down to issues of democratic choices, that we need to have a conversation about these and not the kind of one-sided conversation that Premier Campbell is proposing, but something more meaningful. One of our researchers, Marcy Cohen, talks about applying more democratic principles in the context of the healthcare system. But ultimately, it comes down to that if in a completely private world, technology is going to drive costs higher and higher, and that is sort of what you're seeing in the United States. But within a public system and expanding the realm of that public system, we can have a democratic element to it, and we can have the ability to make choices around these important issues. So thanks very much. I hope you found that interesting.